The Two Towers, Disc 7.
Beneath the mountain's arm, within the wizard's veil, through years uncounted, had stood that ancient place that men called Isengard. Partly it was shaped in the making of the mountains, but mighty works the men of Westerness had wrought there of old, and Saruman had dwelt there long and had not been idle. This was its fashion, while Saruman was at his height, accounted by many the chief of wizards. A great ring wall of stone, like towering cliffs, stood out from the shelter of the mountainside, from which it ran and then returned again. One entrance only was there made in it, a great arch delved in the southern wall. Here through the black rock a long tunnel had been hewn, closed at either end with mighty doors of iron. They were so wrought and poised upon their huge hinges, posts of steel driven into the living stone, that when unbarred they could be moved with a light thrust of the arms, noiselessly. One who passed in and came at length out of the echoing tunnel beheld a plain, a great circle, somewhat hollowed like a vast shallow bowl, a mile it measured from rim to rim. Once it had been green and filled with avenues, and groves of fruitful trees watered by streams that flowed from the mountains to a lake. But no green thing grew there in the latter days of Saruman. The roads were paved with stone flags, dark and hard, and beside their borders, instead of trees, there marched long lines of pillars, some of marble, some of copper and of iron, joined by heavy chains. Many houses there were, chambers, halls, and passages, cut and tunnelled back into the walls upon their inner side, so that all the open circle was overlooked by countless windows and dark doors. Thousands could dwell there, workers, servants, slaves, and warriors with great store of arms. Wolves were fed and stabled in deep dens beneath. The plain, too, was bored and delved. Shafts were driven deep into the ground. Their upper ends were covered by low mounds and domes of stone, so that in the moonlight the ring of Isengard looked like a graveyard of unquiet dead. For the ground trembled. The shafts ran down by many slopes and spiral stairs to caverns far under. There Saruman had treasuries, storehouses, armories, smithies, and great furnaces. Iron wheels revolved there endlessly, and hammers thudded. At night plumes of vapour steamed from the vents, lit from beneath with red light, or blue, or venomous green. To the centre all the roads ran between their chains. There stood a tower of marvellous shape. It was fashioned by the builders of old, who smoothed the ring of Isengard, and yet it seemed a thing not made by the craft of men, but driven from the bones of the earth in the ancient torment of the hills. A peak and isle of rock it was, black and gleaming hard. Four mighty piers of many-sided stone were welded into one. But near the summit they opened into gaping horns, their pinnacles sharp as the points of spears, keen-edged as knives. Between them was a narrow space, and there upon a floor of polished stone, written with strange signs, a man might stand 500 feet above the plain. This was Orthanc, the citadel of Saruman, the name of which had, by design or chance, a twofold meaning. For in the Elvish speech, Orthanc signifies Mount Fang, but in the language of the Mark of old, the cunning mind. A strong place and wonderful was Isengard, and long it had been beautiful, and there great lords had dwelt, the wardens of Gondor upon the west, and wise men that watched the stars. But Saruman had slowly shaped it to his shifting purposes, and made it better, as he thought, being deceived, for all those arts and subtle devices, for which he forsook his former wisdom, and which fondly he imagined were his own, came but from Mordor, so that what he made was naught, only a little copy, a child's model or a slave's flattery, of that vast fortress, armoury, prison, furnace of great power, Barad-dûr, the Dark Tower, which suffered no rival, and laughed at flattery, biding its time, secure in its pride and its immeasurable strength. This was the stronghold of Saruman, as fame reported it. For within living memory the men of Rohan had not passed its gates, save perhaps a few, such as Wormtongue, who came in secret and told no man what they saw. Now Gandalf rode to the great Pillar of the Hand and passed it, and as he did so the riders saw to their wonder that the hand appeared no longer white. It was stained as with dried blood, and looking closer they perceived that its nails were red. Unheeding, Gandalf rode on into the mist, and reluctantly they followed him. All about them now, as if there had been a sudden flood, wide pools of water lay beside the road, filling the hollows, and rills went trickling down among the stones. At last Gandalf halted, and beckoned to them, and they came, and saw that beyond him the mists had cleared, and a pale sunlight shone. The hour of noon had passed. They were come to the doors of Isengard. But the doors lay hurled and twisted on the ground, and all about, stone, cracked and splintered into countless jagged shards, was scattered far and wide, or piled in ruinous heaps. The great arch still stood, but it opened now upon a roofless chasm. The tunnel was laid bare, and through the cliff-like walls on either side great rents and breaches had been torn. Their towers were beaten to dust. If the great sea had risen in wrath and fallen on the hills with storm, it could have worked no greater ruin. The ring beyond was filled with steaming water, a bubbling cauldron, in which there heaved and floated a wreckage of beams and spars, chests and casks and broken gear. Twisted and leaning pillars reared their splintered stems above the flood, but all the roads were drowned. Far off, it seemed, half veiled in winding cloud, there loomed the island rock. Still dark and tall, unbroken by the storm, the tower of Orthanc stood. Pale waters lapped about its feet. The king and all his company sat silent on their horses, marvelling, perceiving that the power of Saruman was overthrown, but how they could not guess. And now they turned their eyes towards the archway and the ruined gates. There they saw close beside them a great rubble heap, and suddenly they were aware of two small figures lying on it at their ease, grey-clad, hardly to be seen among the stones. There were bottles and bowls and platters laid beside them, as if they had just eaten well, and now rested from their labour. One seemed asleep, the other, with crossed legs and arms behind his head, leaned back against a broken rock, and sent from his mouth long wisps and little rings of thin blue smoke. For a moment Théoden and Éomer and all his men stared at them in wonder. Amid all the wreck of Isengard this seemed to them the strangest sight. But before the king could speak, the small smoke-breathing figure became suddenly aware of them, as they sat there silent on the edge of the mist. He sprang to his feet. A young man he looked, or like one, though not much more than half a man in height. His head of brown curling hair was uncovered, but he was clad in a travel-stained cloak of the same hue and shape as the companions of Gandalf had worn when they rode to Edoras. He bowed very low, putting his hand upon his breast. Then, seeming not to observe the wizard and his friends, he turned to Éomer and the king. "Welcome, my lords, to Isengard," he said. "We are the door-wardens. Meriadoc, son of Saradoc, is my name, and my companion, who, alas, is overcome with weariness," he gave the other a dig with his foot, "is Peregrine, son of Paladin, of the House of Took. Far in the north is our home. The Lord Saruman is within, but at the moment he is closeted with one Wormtongue, or doubtless he would be here to welcome such honourable guests."
"Doubtless he would," laughed Gandalf. "And was it Saruman that ordered you to guard his damaged doors and watch for the arrival of guests when your attention could be spared from plate and bottle?"
"No, good sir, the matter escaped him," answered Merry gravely. "He has been much occupied. Our orders came from Treebeard, who has taken over the management of Isengard. He commanded me to welcome the Lord of Rohan with fitting words. I've done my best.
And what about your companions? What about Legolas and me? Cried Gimli, unable to contain himself longer. You rascals, you woolly-footed and wool-pated truants, a fine hunt you've led us, 200 leagues through fen and forest, battle and death to rescue you, and here we find you feasting and idling and smoking, smoking. Where did you come by the weed, you villains? Hammer and tongs, I'm so torn between rage and joy that if I do not burst, it will be a marvel.
You speak for me, Gimli, laughed Legolas, though I would sooner learn how they came by the wine. One thing you've not found in your hunting, and that's brighter wits, said Pippin, opening an eye. Here you find us sitting on a field of victory amid the plunder of armies, and you wonder how we came by a few well-earned comforts.
Well-earned, said Gimli, I can't believe that.
The riders laughed. It cannot be doubted that we witnessed the meeting of dear friends, said Theoden. So these are the lost ones of your company, Gandalf. The days are fated to be filled with marvels. Already I've seen many since I left my house, and now here before my eyes stand yet another of the folk of legend. Are not these the halflings that some among us call the Hobbitlern? Hobbits, if you please, Lord, said Pippin. "Hobbits?" said Theoden. "Your tongue is strangely changed, but the name sounds not unfitting so. Hobbits! No report that I've heard does justice to the truth." Merry bowed, and Pippin got up and bowed low. "You're gracious, Lord, or I hope that I may so take your words," he said. "And here's another marvel. I've wandered in many lands since I left my home, and never till now have I found people that knew any story concerning hobbits." "My people came out of the north long ago," said Theoden. "But I'll not deceive you. We know no tales about hobbits. All that is said among us is that far away, over many hills and rivers, live the halfling folk that dwell in holes in sand dunes. But there are no legends of their deeds, for it's said that they do little, and avoid the sight of men, being able to vanish in a twinkling, and they can change their voices to resemble the piping of birds. But it seems that more could be said."
"It could indeed, Lord," said Merry.
"For one thing," said Theoden, "I hadn't heard that they spouted smoke from their mouths."
"That's not surprising," answered Merry, "for it's an art which we have not practised for more than a few generations. It was Tobold Hornblower, or Longbottom in the South Farthing, who first grew the true pipeweed in his gardens, about the year 1070, according to our reckoning. How old Toby came by the plant?"
"You don't know your danger, Theoden," interrupted Gandalf. "These hobbits will sit on the edge of ruin and discuss the pleasures of the table, or the small doings of their fathers, grandfathers and great-grandfathers, and remoter cousins to the ninth degree, if you encourage them with undue patience. Some other time would be more fitting for the history of smoking. Where's Treebeard, Merry?"
"Away on the north side, I believe. He went to get a drink of clean water. Most of the other Ents are with him, still busy at their work, over there." Merry waved his hand towards the steaming lake, and as they looked, they heard a distant rumbling and rattling, as if an avalanche was falling from the mountainside. Far away came a hum-hum, as of horns blowing triumphantly.
"And is Orthanc then left unguarded?" asked Gandalf.
"There's the water," said Merry, "but Quickbeam and some others are watching it. Not all those posts and pillars in the plain are of Saruman's planting. Quickbeam, I think, is by the rock, near the foot of the stair." "Yes, a tall grey Ent is there," said Legolas, "but his arms are at his sides, and he stands as still as a door-tree."
"It is past noon," said Gandalf, "and we at any rate have not eaten since early morning. Yet I wish to see Treebeard as soon as may be. Did he leave me no message, or has plate and bottle driven it from your mind?"
"He left a message," said Merry, "and I was coming to it, but I've been hindered by many other questions."
I was to say that, if the Lord of the Mark and Gandalf will ride to the northern wall, they will find Treebeard there, and he'll welcome them. I may add that they'll also find food of the best there. It was discovered and selected by your humble servants. He bowed.
Gandalf laughed. That's better, he said. Well, Theoden, will you ride with me to find Treebeard? We must go round about, but it's not far. When you see Treebeard, you will learn much, for Treebeard is Fangorn, and the eldest and chief of the Ents, and when you speak with him, you will hear the speech of the oldest of all living things.
I will come with you, said Theoden. Farewell, my hobbits. May we meet again in my house. There you shall sit beside me and tell me all that your hearts desire, the deeds of your grandsires, as far as you can reckon them, and we will speak also of Tobold the Old and his herb lore. Farewell.
The hobbits bowed low.
So that is the King of Rohan, said Pippin in an undertone. A fine old fellow, very polite.
Chapter 9. Flotsam and Jetsam. Gandalf and the king's company rode away, turning eastward to make the circuit of the ruined walls of Isengard. But Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas remained behind. Leaving Arod and Harsafell to stray in search of grass, they came and sat beside the hobbits.
Well, well, the hunt is over, and we meet again at last, where none of us ever thought to come, said Aragorn.
And now that the great ones have gone to discuss high matters, said Legolas, the hunters can perhaps learn the answers to their own small riddles. We tracked you as far as the forest, but there are still many things that I should like to know the truth of.
And there is a great deal, too, that we want to know about you, said Merry. We've learned a few things through Treebeard, the old Ent, but that's not nearly enough.
All in good time, said Legolas. We were the hunters, and you should give an account of yourselves to us first.
Or second, said Gimli. It would go better after a meal. I have a sore head, and it's past midday. You truants might make amends by finding us some of the plunder that you spoke of. Food and drink would pay off some of my score against you.
Then you shall have it, said Pippin. Will you have it here, or in more comfort in what's left of Saruman's guardhouse, over there under the arch? We had to picnic out here, so as to keep an eye on the road.
Less than an eye, said Gimli. But I'll not go into an orc house, nor touch orcs' meat or anything that they've mauled.
We wouldn't ask you to do that, said Merry. We've had enough of orcs ourselves to last a lifetime. But there were many other folk in Isengard. Saruman kept enough wisdom not to trust his orcs. He had men to guard his gates. Some of his most faithful servants, I suppose. Anyway, they were favoured and got good provisions.
And pipeweed? Asked Gimli.
No, I don't think so, Merry laughed. But that's another story, which can wait until after lunch.
Well, let's go and have lunch then, said the dwarf.
The hobbits led the way, and they passed under the arch and came to a wide door upon the left, at the top of a stair. It opened direct into a large chamber, with other smaller doors at the far end, and a hearth and chimney at one side. The chamber was hewn out of the stone, and it must once have been dark, for its windows looked out only into the tunnel, but light came in now through the broken roof. On the hearth wood was burning.
"I lit a bit of fire," said Pippin. "It cheered us up in the fogs. There were few faggots about, and most of the wood we could find was wet. But there's a great draught in the chimney. It seems to wind away up through the rock, and fortunately it hasn't been blocked. A fire is handy. I will make you some toast. The bread is 3 or 4 days old, I'm afraid." Aragorn and his companions sat themselves down at one end of a long table, and the hobbits disappeared through one of the inner doors.
"Storeroom in there, and above the floods, luckily," said Pippin, as they came back laden with dishes, bowls, cups, knives, and food of various sorts.
"And you needn't turn up your nose at the provender, Master Gimli," said Merry. "This is not orc stuff, but man-food, as Treebeard calls it. Will you have wine or beer?
There's a barrel inside there, very passable, and this is first-rate salted pork. Or I can cut you some rashers of bacon and broil them, if you like. I'm sorry there's no green stuff. The deliveries have been rather interrupted in the last few days. I can't offer you anything to follow but butter and honey for your bread. Are you content?
Indeed, yes, said Gimli. The score is much reduced.
The three were soon busy with their meal, and the two hobbits, unabashed, set to a second time.
We must keep our guests company, they said.
You are full of courtesy this morning, laughed Legolas. But maybe, if we hadn't arrived, you'd already have been keeping one another company again.
Maybe, and why not, said Pippin. We had foul fare with the orcs, and little enough for days before that. It seems a long while since we could eat to heart's content.
It doesn't seem to have done you any harm, said Aragorn. Indeed, you look in the bloom of health. Aye, you do indeed, said Gimli,
looking them up and down over the top of his cup.
Why, your hair is twice as thick and curly as when we parted, and I would swear that you've both grown somewhat, if that's possible for hobbits of your age. This tree beard, at any rate, has not starved you.
He hasn't, said Merry. But Ents only drink, and drink isn't enough for content.
Treebeard's draughts may be nourishing, but one feels the need of something solid, and even Lembas is none the worse for a change.
You've drunk of the waters of the Ents, have you? Said Legolas.
Ah, then I think it's likely that Gimli's eyes don't deceive him. Strange songs have been sung of the draughts of Fangorn.
Many strange tales have been told about that land, said Aragorn. I've never entered it. Come, tell me more about it, and about the Ents.
Ents, said Pippin. Ents are all different for one thing, but their eyes are very odd.
He tried a few fumbling words that trailed off into silence.
Oh, well, he went on, you've seen some at a distance already. They saw you at any rate, and reported that you were on the way, and you'll see many others, I expect, before you leave here. You must form your own ideas.
Now, said Gimli. We're beginning the story in the middle. I should like a tale in the right order, starting with that strange day when our fellowship was broken.
You shall have it, if there is time, said Merry. But first, if you've finished eating, you shall fill your pipes and light up, and then for a little while we can pretend that we're all back safe at Bree again, or in Rivendell.
He produced a small leather bag full of tobacco.
We have heaps of it, he said, and you can all pack as much as you wish when we go. We did some salvage work this morning, Pippin and I. There are lots of things floating about. It was Pippin who found two small barrels, washed up out of some cellar or storehouse, I suppose. When we opened them, we found they were filled with this, as fine a pipe weed as you could wish for, and quite unspoiled. Gimli took some and rubbed it in his palms and sniffed it.
It feels good, and it smells good, he said.
It is good, said Merry. My dear Gimli, it is long-bottom leaf. There were the hornblower brand marks on the barrels, as plain as plain. How it came here I can't imagine. For Saruman's private use, I fancy. I never knew that it went so far abroad, but it comes in handy now.
It would, said Gimli, if I had a pipe to go with it. Alas, I lost mine in Moria, more before. Is there no pipe in all your plunder?
No, I'm afraid not, said Merry. We've not found any, not even here in the guard-rooms. Saruman kept this dainty to himself, it seems, and I don't think it would be any use knocking on the doors of Orthonk to beg a pipe of him. We shall have to share pipes, as good friends must at a pinch.
Half a moment, said Pippin. Putting his hand inside the breast of his jacket, he pulled out a little soft wallet on a string. I keep a treasure or two near my skin, as precious as rings to me. Here's one, my old wooden pipe. And here's another, an unused one. I've carried it a long way, though I don't know why. I never really expected to find any pipeweed on the journey, when my own ran out, but now it comes in useful after all.
He held up a small pipe with a wide flattened bowl and handed it to Gimli. "Does that settle the score between us?" he said.
"Settle it," cried Gimli. "Most noble hobbit, it leaves me deep in your debt."
"Well, I'm going back into the open air to see what the wind and sky are doing," said Legolas.
"We'll come with you," said Aragorn.
They went out and seated themselves upon the piled stones before the gateway. They could see far down into the valley now. The mists were lifting and floating away upon the breeze.
"Now let's take our ease here for a little," said Aragorn. "We'll sit on the edge of ruin and talk, as Gandalf says, while he's busy elsewhere. I feel a weariness such as I've seldom felt before."
He wrapped his grey cloak about him, hiding his mail shirt, and stretched out his long legs. Then he lay back and sent from his lips a thin stream of smoke.
"Look," said Pippin. "Strider the ranger has come back."
"He's never been away," said Aragorn. "I am Strider and Dornadan too, and I belong both to Gondor and the North."
They smoked in silence for a while, and the sun shone on them, slanting into the valley from among white clouds high in the west. Legolas lay still, looking up at the sun and sky with steady eyes, and singing softly to himself. At last he sat up.
"Come now," he said. "Time wears on, and the mists are blowing away, or would if you strange folk didn't wreathe yourselves in smoke. What of the tale?"
"Well, my tale begins with waking up in the dark and finding myself all strung up in an orc camp," said Pippin. "Let me see. What's today?"
"The 5th of March in the Shire Reckoning," said Aragorn. Pippin made some calculations on his fingers.
"Only 9 days ago," he said. "It seems a year since we were caught. Well, though half of it was like a bad dream, I reckon that 3 very horrible days followed. Mary will correct me if I forget anything important. I'm not going into details. The whips and the filth and stench and all that, it doesn't bear remembering."
With that he plunged into an account of Boromir's last fight and the orc march from Eminweal to the forest. The others nodded as the various points were fitted in with their guesses.
"Here are some treasures that you let fall," said Aragorn. "You'll be glad to have them back."
He loosened his belt from under his cloak, and took from it the 2 sheathed knives.
"Well," said Merry, "I never expected to see those again. I marked a few orcs with mine, but Ugluk took them from us. How he glared! At first I thought he was going to stab me, but he threw the things away as if they burned him."
"And here is also your brooch, Pippin," said Aragorn. "I've kept it safe, for it's a very precious thing."
"I know," said Pippin. "It was a wrench to let it go, but what else could I do?"
"Nothing else," answered Aragorn. "One who can't cast away a treasure at need is in fetters. You did rightly."
"The cutting of the bands on your wrists, that was smart work," said Gimli. "Luck served you there, but you seized your chance with both hands, one might say."
"And set us a pretty riddle," said Legolas. "I wondered if you'd grown wings."
"Unfortunately not," said Pippin. "But you didn't know about Grishnak."
He shuddered and said no more, leaving Merry to tell of those last horrible moments, the pawing hands, the hot breath, and the dreadful stench of Grishnak's hairy arms.
"All this about the orcs of Barad-dûr, Lugbors as they call it, makes me uneasy," said Aragorn. "The Dark Lord already knew too much, and his servants also, and Grishnak evidently sent some message across the river after the quarrel. The Red Eye will be looking towards Isengard, but Saruman at any rate is in a cleft stick of his own cutting."
"Yes, whichever side wins, his outlook is poor," said Merry. "Things began to go all wrong for him from the moment his orcs set foot in Rohan."
"We caught a glimpse of the old villain, or so Gandalf hints," said Gimli, "on the edge of the forest."
"When was that?"
asked Pippin. 5 nights ago," said Aragorn. "Let me see," said Merry. 5 nights ago? Now we come to a part of the story you know nothing about. We met Treebeard that morning after the battle, and that night
we were at Welling Hall, one of his ent-houses. The next morning we went to Entmoot, a gathering events, that is, and the queerest thing I've ever seen in my life. It lasted all that day and the next, and we spent the nights with an ent called Quickbeam. And then late in the afternoon, in the third day of their moot, the ent suddenly blew up. It was amazing. The forest had felt as tense as if a thunderstorm was brewing inside it. Then all at once it exploded. I wish you could have heard their song as they marched. If Saruman had heard it, he would be 100 miles away by now, even if he had had to run on his own legs, said Pippin. Though Isengard be strong and hard as cold as stone and bare as bone, we go, we go, we go to war to hew the stone and break the door. There was very much more. A great deal of the song had no words and was like a music of horns and drums. It was very exciting. But I thought it was only marching music and no more, just a song, until I got here. I know better now. We came down over the last ridge into Nan Cúranir, after night had fallen, Mary continued. It was then that I first had the feeling that the forest itself was moving behind us. I thought I was dreaming an entish dream, but Pippin had noticed it too. We were both frightened, but we didn't find out more about it until later. It was the Huorns, or so the Ents call them in short language. Treebeard won't say much about them, but I think they're Ents that have become almost like trees, at least to look at. They stand here and there in the wood or under its eaves, silent, watching endlessly over the trees, but deep in the darkest dales there are hundreds and hundreds of them, I believe. There's a great power in them, and they seem able to wrap themselves in shadow. It's difficult to see them moving, but they do. They can move very quickly if they're angry. You stand still looking at the weather, maybe, or listening to the rustling of the wind, and then suddenly you find that you're in the middle of a wood with great groping trees all around you. They still have voices and can speak with the Ents. That's why they are called Huorns, Treebeard says, but they have become queer and wild, dangerous. I should be terrified of meeting them if there were no true Ents about to look after them. Well, in the early night we crept down a long ravine into the upper end of the Wizard's Vale, the Ents with all their rustling horns behind them. We couldn't see them, of course, but the whole air was full of creaking. It was very dark, a cloudy night. They moved at a great speed as soon as they'd left the hills and made a noise like a rushing wind. The moon didn't appear through the clouds, and not long after midnight there was a tall wood all round the north side of Isengard. There was no sign of enemies, nor of any challenge. There was a light gleaming from a high window in the tower, that was all. Treebeard and a few more Ents crept on, right round to within sight of the great gates. Pippin and I were with him. We were sitting on Treebeard's shoulders, and I could feel the quivering tenseness in him. But even when they're aroused, Ents can be very cautious and patient. They stood still as carved stones, breathing and listening. Then all at once there was a tremendous stir. Trumpets blared, and the walls of Isengard echoed. We thought that we'd been discovered, and that battle was going to begin. But nothing of the sort. All Saruman's people were marching away. I don't know much about this war, or about the horsemen of Rohan, but Saruman seems to have meant to finish off the king and all his men with one final blow. He emptied Isengard. I saw the enemy go, endless lines of marching orcs and troops of them mounted on great wolves. And there were battalions of men, too. Many of them carried torches, and in the flare I could see their faces. Most of them were ordinary men, rather tall and dark-haired, and grim but not particularly evil-looking. But there were some others that were horrible, man-high, but with goblin faces, sallow, leering, squint-eyed. Do you know, they reminded me at once of that southerner at Bree, only he was not so obviously orc-like as most of these were.
"I thought of him too," said Aragorn. "We had many of these half-orcs to deal with at Helm's Deep. It seems plain now
that southerner was a spy of Saruman's, but whether he was working with the Black Riders or for Saruman alone, I don't know. It's difficult with these evil folk to know when they're in league and when they are cheating one another.
Well, of all sorts together, there must have been 10,000 at the very least, said Merry.
They took an hour to pass out of the gates. Some went off down the highway to the fords, and some turned away and went eastward. A bridge has been built down there, about a mile away, where the river runs in a very deep channel. You could see it now if you stood up. They were all singing with harsh voices and laughing, making a hideous din. I thought things looked very black for Rohan, but Treebeard didn't move. He said,
"My business is with Isengard tonight, with rock and stone."
But though I couldn't see what was happening in the dark, I believe that horns began to move south as soon as the gates were shut again. Their business was with orcs, I think. They were far down the valley in the morning, or at any rate there was a shadow there that one couldn't see through. As soon as Saruman had sent off his army, our turn came. Treebeard put us down and went up to the gates and began hammering on the doors and calling for Saruman. There was no answer except arrows and stones from the walls. But arrows are no use against Ents. They hurt them, of course, and infuriate them, like stinging flies. But an Ent can be stuck as full of orc arrows as a pincushion and take no serious harm. They can't be poisoned, for one thing, and their skin seems to be very thick and tougher than bark. It takes a very heavy axe stroke to wound them seriously. They don't like axes, but there would have to be a great many axemen to one Ent. A man that hacks once at an Ent never gets a chance of a second blow. A punch from an Ent fist crumples up iron like thin tin. When Treebeard had got a few arrows in him, he began to warm up to get positively hasty, as he would say. He let out a great hoom hoom, and a dozen more Ents came striding up. An angry Ent is terrifying. Their fingers and their toes just freeze on to rock, and they tear it up like bread crusts. It was like watching the work of great tree roots in 100 years, all packed into a few moments. They pushed, pulled, tore, shook, and hammered, and clang-bang, crash-crack. In 5 minutes they had these huge gates just lying in ruin, and some were already beginning to eat into the walls like rabbits in a sandpit. I don't know what Saruman thought was happening, but anyway he didn't know how to deal with it. His wizardry may have been falling off lately, of course, but anyway I think he hasn't much grit. Not much plain courage alone in a tight place without a lot of slaves and machines and things, if you know what I mean. Very different from old Gandalf. I wonder if his fame was not all along mainly due to his cleverness in settling at Isengard.
No, said Aragorn. Once he was as great as his fame made him. His knowledge was deep, his thought was subtle, and his hands marvellously skilled, and he had a power over the minds of others. The wise he could persuade, and the smaller folk he could daunt. That power he certainly still keeps. There are not many in Middle-earth that I should say were safe, if they were left alone to talk with him, even now when he has suffered a defeat. Gandalf, Elrond, and Galadriel, perhaps, now that his wickedness has been laid bare, but very few others.
The Ents are safe, said Pippin. He seems at one time to have got round them, but never again. And anyway, he didn't understand them, and he made the great mistake of leaving them out of his calculations. He had no plan for them, and there was no time to make any, once they'd set to work. As soon as our attack began, the few remaining rats in Isengard started bolting through every hole that the Ents made. The Ents let the men go, after they'd questioned them, 2 or 3 dozen only, down at this end. I don't think many orc folk of any size escaped. Not from the horns. There was a wood full of them all around Isengard by that time, as well as those that had gone down the valley. When the Ents had reduced a large part of the southern walls to rubbish, and what was left of his people had bolted and deserted him, Saruman fled in panic. "'He seems to have been at the gates when we arrived. "'I expect he came to watch his splendid army march out. "'When the Ents broke their way in, he left in a hurry. "'They didn't spot him at first, but the night had opened out, "'and there was a great light of stars, quite enough for Ents to see by, "'and suddenly Quickbeam gave a cry.
"'The tree-killer! The tree-killer!'
"'Quickbeam is a gentle creature,' But he hates Saruman all the more fiercely for that. His people suffered cruelly from orc axes. He leapt down the path from the inner gate, and he can move like a wind when he's roused. There was a pale figure hurrying away in and out of the shadows of the pillar, and it had nearly reached the stairs to the tower top. But it was a near thing. Quickbeam was so hot after him that he was within a step or two of being caught and strangled when he slipped in through the door. When Saruman was safe back in Orthonk, it wasn't long before he set some of his precious machinery to work. By that time there were many Ents inside Isengard. Some had followed Quickbeam, and others had burst in from the north and east. They were roaming about and doing a great deal of damage. Suddenly up came fires and foul fumes. The vents and shafts all over the plain began to spout and belch. Several of the Ents got scorched and blistered. One of them, Beachbone, I think he was called, a very tall, handsome Ent, got caught in a spray of some liquid fire and burned like a torch, a horrible sight. That sent them mad. I thought that they'd been really roused before, but I was wrong. I saw what it was like at last. It was staggering. They roared and boomed and trumpeted until stones began to crack and fall at the mere noise of them. Mary and I lay on the ground and stuffed our cloaks into our ears. Round and round the rock of Orthonk, the Ents went striding and storming like a howling gale, breaking pillars, hurling avalanches of boulders down the shafts, tossing up huge slabs of stone into the air like leaves. The tower was in the middle of a spinning whirlwind. I saw iron posts and blocks of masonry go rocketing up hundreds of feet and smash against the windows of Orthanc. But Treebeard kept his head. He hadn't got any burns, luckily. He didn't want his folk to hurt themselves in their fury, and he didn't want Saruman to escape out of some hole in the confusion. Many of the Ents were hurling themselves against the Orthanc rock, but that defeated them. It's very smooth and hard. Some wizardry is in it, perhaps, older and stronger than Saruman's. Anyway, they couldn't get a grip on it, or make a crack in it, and they were bruising and wounding themselves against it. So Treebeard went out into the ring and shouted. His enormous voice rose above all the din. There was a dead silence, suddenly. In it we heard a shrill laugh from a high window in the tower. That had a queer effect on the Ents. They'd been boiling over. Now they became cold, grim as ice, and quiet. They left the plain and gathered round Treebeard, standing quite still. He spoke to them for a little in their own language. I think he was telling them of a plan he had made in his old head long before. Then they just faded silently away in the grey light. Day was dawning by that time. They set a watch on the tower, I believe. But the watchers were so well hidden in shadows and kept so still that I couldn't see them. The others went away north. All that day they were busy, out of sight. Most of the time we were left alone. It was a dreary day, and we wandered about a bit, though we kept out of the view of the windows of Orthonk as much as we could. They stared at us so threateningly. A good deal of the time we spent looking for something to eat. And also we sat and talked, wondering what was happening away south in Rohan, and what had become of all the rest of our company. Every now and then we could hear in the distance the rattle and fall of stone and thudding noises echoing in the hills. In the afternoon we walked round the circle and went to have a look at what was going on. There was a great shadowy wood of Huorns at the head of the valley, and another round the northern wall. We didn't dare to go in, but there was a rending, tearing noise of work going on inside. Ents and Huorns were digging great pits and trenches, and making great pools and dams, gathering all the waters of the Eisen and every other spring and stream that they could find. We left them to it. At dusk, Treebeard came back to the gate. He was humming and booming to himself, and he seemed pleased. He stood and stretched his great arms and legs and breathed deep. I asked him if he was tired.
"Tired?" he said. "Tired? Well, no, not tired, but stiff. I need a good draught of Entwash. We've worked hard. We've done more stone-cracking and earth-gnawing today than we've done in many a long year before. But it's nearly finished. When night falls, don't linger near this gate or in the old tunnel. Water may come through, and it'll be foul water for a while, until all the filth of Saruman is washed away. Then Eisen can run clean again."
He began to pull down a bit more of the walls, in a leisurely sort of way, just to amuse himself. We were just wondering where it would be safe to lie and get some sleep, when the most amazing thing of all happened. There was the sound of a rider coming swiftly up the road. Mary and I lay quiet, and Treebeard hid himself in the shadows under the arch. Suddenly a great horse came striding up like a flash of silver. It was already dark, but I could see the rider's face clearly. It seemed to shine, and all his clothes were white. I just sat up staring with my mouth open. I tried to call out and couldn't. There was no need. He halted just by us and looked down at us. "Gandalf," I said at last, but my voice was only a whisper.
Did he say,
"Hello, Pippin, this is a pleasant surprise."
"No, indeed," he said.
"Get up, you tomfool of a Took. Where in the name of wonder, in all this ruin, is Treebeard? I want him, quick."
Treebeard heard his voice and came out of the shadows at once, and there was a strange meeting. I was surprised, because neither of them seemed surprised at all. Gandalf obviously expected to find Treebeard here, and Treebeard might almost have been loitering about near the gates on purpose to meet him. Yet we'd told the old Ent all about Moria. But then I remembered a queer look he gave us at the time. I can only suppose that he'd seen Gandalf or had some news of him, but wouldn't say anything in a hurry.
"Don't be hasty," is his motto, but nobody, not even elves, will say much about Gandalf's movements when he's not there.
"Whom, Gandalf," said Treebeard, "I'm glad you've come. Wood and water, stock and stone, I can master, but there is a wizard to manage here." "Treebeard," said Gandalf, "I need your help. You've done much, but I need more. I have about 10,000 orcs to manage."
Then those two went off and had a council together in some corner. It must have seemed very hasty to Treebeard, for Gandalf was in a tremendous hurry, and was already talking at a great pace before they passed out of hearing. They were only away a matter of minutes, perhaps a quarter of an hour. Then Gandalf came back to us, and he seemed relieved, almost merry. He did say he was glad to see us then. "But Gandalf," I cried, "where have you been? And have you seen the others?"
"Wherever I have been, I am back," he answered in the genuine Gandalf manner. "Yes, I've seen some of the riders, but news must wait. This is a perilous night, and I must ride fast. But the dawn may be brighter, and if so, we shall meet again. Take care of yourselves, and keep away from Orthanc. Goodbye."
Treebeard was very thoughtful after Gandalf had gone. He'd evidently learned a lot in a short time and was digesting it. He looked at us and said,
"Well, I find you're not such hasty folk as I thought. You said much less than you might, but not more than you should. This is a bundle of news and no mistake. Well, now, Treebeard must get busy again."
Before he went, we got a little news out of him, and it didn't cheer us up at all. But for the moment we thought more about you three than about Frodo and Sam, or about poor Boromir, for we gathered that there was a great battle going on, or soon would be, and that you were in it and might never come out of it.
horns will help," said Treebeard.
Then he went away, and we didn't see him again until this morning. It was deep night. We lay on top of a pile of stone, and we could see nothing beyond it. Mr. Shadows blotted out everything like a great blanket all round us. The air seemed hot and heavy, and it was full of rustlings, creakings, and a murmur like voices passing. I think that hundreds more of the horns must have been passing by to help in the battle. Later there was a great rumble of thunder away south, and flashes of lightning far away across Rohan. Every now and then we could see mountain peaks, miles and miles away, stab out suddenly, black and white, and then vanish. And behind us there were noises like thunder in hills, but different. At times the whole valley echoed. It must have been about midnight when the Ents broke the dams and poured all the gathered waters through a gap in the northern wall, down into Isengard. The Horn Dark had passed, and the thunder had rolled away. The moon was sinking behind the western mountains. Isengard began to fill up with black, creeping streams and pools. They glittered in the last light of the moon as they spread over the plain. Every now and then the waters found their way down into some shaft or spout hole. Great white steams hissed up. Smoke rose in billows. There were explosions and gusts of fire. One great coil of vapour went whirling up, twisting round and round Orthonk, until it looked like a tall peak of cloud, fiery underneath and moonlit above. And still more water poured in, until at last Isengard looked like a huge flat saucepan, all steaming and bubbling.
"We saw a cloud of smoke and steam from the south last night, when we came to the mouth of Nan Coronir," said Aragorn. "We feared that Saruman was brewing some new devilry for us."
"Not he," said Pippin.
"He was probably choking and not laughing any more. By the morning, yesterday morning, the water had sunk down into all the holes, and there was a dense fog. We took refuge in that guard-room over there, and we had rather a fright. The lake began to overflow and pour out through the old tunnel, and the water was rapidly rising up the steps. We thought we were going to get caught like orcs in a hole, but we found a winding stair at the back of the storeroom that brought us out at the top of the arch. It was a squeeze to get out, as the passages had been cracked and half blocked with fallen stone near the top. There we sat high up above the floods and watched the drowning of Isengard. The Ents kept on pouring in more water till all the fires were quenched and every cave filled. The fog slowly gathered together and steamed up into a huge umbrella of cloud. It must have been a mile high. In the evening there was a great rainbow over the eastern hills, and then the sunset was blotted out by a thick drizzle on the mountainsides. It all went very quiet. A few wolves howled mournfully, far away. The Ents stopped the inflow in the night, and sent the Isen back into its old course, and that was the end of it all. Since then the water's been sinking again. There must be outlets somewhere from the caves underneath, I think.
If Saruman peeps out of any of his windows, it must look an untidy, dreary mess.
We felt very lonely. Not even a visible Ent to talk to in all the ruin, and no news. We spent the night up on top there, above the arch, and it was cold and damp, and we didn't sleep. We had a feeling that anything might happen at any minute. Saruman's still in his tower. There was a noise in the night, like a wind coming up the valley. I think the Ents and Horns that had been away came back then. But where they've all gone to now, I don't know. It was a misty, moisty morning when we climbed down and looked round again, and nobody was about. And that is about all there is to tell. It seems almost peaceful now, after all the turmoil, and safer too, somehow, since Gandalf came back. I could sleep.
They all fell silent for a while. Gimli refilled his pipe. "There's one thing I wonder about," he said as he lit it with his flint and tinder. "Wormtongue, you told Théoden he was with Saruman. How did he get there?"
"Oh, yes, I forgot about him," said Pippin. He didn't get here till this morning. We'd just lit the fire and had some breakfast when Treebeard appeared again. We heard him homing and calling our names outside.
"I've just come round to see how you're faring, my lads," he said, "and to give you some news. Hoorns have come back. All's well. Aye, very well indeed."
He laughed and slapped his thighs.
"No more orcs in Isengard, no more axes, and there will be folk coming up from the south before the day is old, some that you may be glad to see."
He'd hardly said that when we heard the sound of hoofs on the road. We rushed out before the gates, and I stood and stared, half expecting to see Strider and Gandalf come riding up at the head of an army. But out of the mist there rode a man on an old, tired horse, and he looked a queer, twisted sort of creature himself. There was no one else. When he came out of the mist and suddenly saw all the ruin and wreckage in front of him, he sat and gaped, and his face went almost green. He was so bewildered that he didn't seem to notice us at first. When he did, he gave a cry, and tried to turn his horse round and ride off. But Treebeard took three strides, put out a long arm, and lifted him out of the saddle. His horse bolted in terror, and he grovelled on the ground. He said he was Grima, friend and counsellor of the king, and had been sent with important messages from Theoden to Saruman. "No one else would dare to ride through the open land so full of foul orcs," he said, "so I was sent. And I've had a perilous journey, and I'm hungry and weary. I fled far north out of my way, pursued by wolves." I caught the sideways look he gave to Treebeard, and I said to myself, "Liar." Treebeard looked at him in his long, slow way for several minutes, till the wretched man was squirming on the floor. Then at last he said,
"I was expecting you, Master Wormtongue."
The man started at that name.
"Gandalf got here first, so I know as much about you as I need, and I know what to do with you. Put all the rats in one trap," says Gandalf, "and I will. I am the master of Isengard now, but Saruman is locked in his tower, and you can go there and give him all the messages that you can think of."
"Let me go, let me go," said Wormtongue. "I know the way."
"You knew the way, I don't doubt," said Treebeard, "but things have changed here a little. Go and see."
He let Wormtongue go, and he limped off through the arch, with us close behind, until he came inside the ring and could see all the floods that lay between him and Orthanc. Then he turned to us.
"Let me go away," he whined. "Let me go away. My messages are useless now." "They are indeed," said Treebeard. "But you have only two choices, to stay with me until Gandalf and your master arrive, or to cross the water. Which will you have?"
The man shivered at the mention of his master, and put a foot into the water, but he drew back.
"I cannot swim," he said. "The water is not deep," said Treebeard. "It is dirty, but that will not harm you, Master Wormtongue. In you go now."
With that the wretch floundered off into the flood. It rose up nearly to his neck before he got too far away for me to see him. The last I saw of him was clinging to some old barrel or piece of wood. But Treebeard waded after him and watched his progress.
"Well, he has gone in," he said when he returned. "I saw him crawling up the steps like a draggled rat. There's someone in the tower still. A hand came out and pulled him in. So there he is, and I hope the welcome is to his liking. Now I must go and wash myself clean of the slime. I'll be away up on the north side, if anyone wants to see me. There's no clean water down here fit for an ent to drink, or to bathe in. So I will ask you two lads to keep a watch at the gate for the folk that are coming. There'll be the Lord of the Fields of Rohan, mark you. You must welcome him as well as you know how. His men have fought a great fight with the orcs. Maybe you know the right fashion of men's words for such a lord better than Ents. There have been many lords in the green fields in my time, and I've never heard their speech or their names. They will be wanting man-food, and you know all about that, I guess. So find what you think is fit for a king to eat, if you can."
And that is the end of the story. though I should like to know who this Wormtongue is. Was he really the king's counsellor?"
"He was," said Aragorn, "and also Saruman's spy and servant in Rohan. Fate hasn't been kinder to him than he deserves. The sight of the ruin of all that he thought so strong and magnificent must have been almost punishment enough. But I fear that worse awaits him."
"Yes, I don't suppose Treebeard sent him to Orthanc out of kindness," said Merry. "He seemed rather grimly delighted with the business, and was laughing to himself when he went to get his bathe and drink. We spent a busy time after that, searching the flotsam and rummaging about. We found 2 or 3 storerooms in different places nearby, above the flood level, but Treebeard sent some Ents down, and they carried off a great deal of the stuff."
"We want man food for 25, the Ent said.
"So you can see that somebody had counted your company carefully before you arrived. You three were evidently meant to go with the great people. But you wouldn't have fared any better. We kept as good as we sent, I promise you. Better, because we sent no drink."
"What about drink?" I said to the Ents.
"There is water of Isen," they said, "and that is good enough for Ents and men."
"But I hope that the Ents may have found time to brew some of their draughts from the mountain springs, and we shall see Gandalf's beard curling when he returns." After the Ents had gone, we felt tired and hungry. But we didn't grumble. Our labours had been well rewarded. It was through our search for man-food that Pippin discovered the prize of all the flotsam, those hornblower barrels. "Pipeweed is better after food," said Pippin. That is how the situation arose.
"We understand it all perfectly now," said Gimli.
"All except one thing," said Aragorn. "Leaf from the South Farthing in Isengard. The more I consider it, the more curious I find it. I've never been in Isengard, but I've journeyed in this land, and I know well the empty countries that lie between Rohan and the Shire. Neither goods nor folk have passed that way for many a long year, not openly. Saruman had secret dealings with someone in the Shire, I guess. Wormtongues may be found in other houses than King Theoden's. Was there a date on the barrels?"
"Yes," said Pippin. "It was the 1417 crop. That is last year's. No, the year before, of course, now. A good year."
"Ah, well, whatever evil was afoot is over now, I hope. Or else it's beyond our reach at present," said Aragorn. "Yet I think I shall mention it to Gandalf, small matter though it may seem among his great affairs."
"I wonder what he's doing," said Merry. "The afternoon is getting on. Let's go and look around. You can enter Isengard now at any rate, Strider, if you want to. But it's not a very cheerful sight."
Chapter 10. The Voice of Saruman. They passed through the ruined tunnel and stood upon a heap of stones, gazing at the dark rock of Orthanc, and its many windows, a menace still in the desolation that lay all about it. The waters had now nearly all subsided. Here and there gloomy pools remained, covered with scum and wreckage. But most of the wide circle was bare again, a wilderness of slime and tumbled rock, pitted with blackened holes and dotted with posts and pillars leaning drunkenly this way and that. At the rim of the shattered bowl there lay vast mounds and slopes, like the shingles cast up by a great storm, and beyond them the green and tangled valley ran up into the long ravine between the dark arms of the mountains. Across the waste they saw riders picking their way. They were coming from the north side, and already they were drawing near to Orthanc.
"There is Gandalf, and Theoden and his men," said Legolas. "Let's go and meet them."
"Walk warily," said Merry. "There are loose slabs that may tilt up and throw you down into a pit if you don't take care."
They followed what was left of the road from the gates to Orthanc, going slowly, for the flagstones were cracked and slimed. The riders, seeing them approach, halted under the shadow of the rock and waited for them. Gandalf rode forward to meet them.
"Well, Treebeard and I have had some interesting discussions and made a few plans," he said, "and we've all had some much-needed rest. Now we must be going on again. I hope you companions have all rested too and refreshed yourselves."
"We have," said Merry, "but our discussions began and ended in smoke. Still we feel less ill-disposed towards Saruman than we did."
"Do you indeed?" said Gandalf. "Well, I don't. I've now a last task to do before I go. I must pay Saruman a farewell visit. Dangerous and probably useless, but it must be done. Those of you who wish may come with me, but beware, and don't jest. This isn't the time for it."
"I'll come," said Gimli. "I wish to see him and learn if he really looks like you."
"And how would you learn that, Master Dwarf?" said Gandalf. "Saruman could look like me, in your eyes, if it suited his purpose with you.
And are you yet wise enough to detect all his counterfeits?"
"Well, we shall see, perhaps. He may be shy of showing himself before many different eyes together, but I've ordered all the Ents to remove themselves from sight, so perhaps we shall persuade him to come out."
"What's the danger?" asked Pippin.
"Will he shoot at us, and pour fire out of the windows, or can he put a spell on us from a distance?"
"The last is more likely, if you ride to his door with a light heart," said Gandalf. "But there's no knowing what he can do, or may choose to try. A wild beast cornered is not safe to approach, and Saruman has powers you don't guess. Beware of his voice."
They came now to the foot of Orthonk. It was black, and the rock gleamed as if it were wet. The many faces of the stone had sharp edges, as though they had been newly chiselled. A few scorings, and small flake-like splinters near the base, were all the marks that it bore of the fury of the Ents. On the eastern side, in the angle of two piers, there was a great door, high above the ground, and over it was a shuttered window, opening upon a balcony hedged with iron bars. Up to the threshold of the door there mounted a flight of 27 broad stairs, hewn by some unknown art of the same black stone. This was the only entrance to the tower, but many tall windows were cut with deep embrasures in the climbing walls. Far up they peered like little eyes in the sheer faces of the horns. At the foot of the stairs Gandalf and the king dismounted.
"I'll go up," said Gandalf. "I've been in Orthonk, and I know my peril."
"And I too will go up," said the king. "I'm old, and fear no peril any more. I wish to speak with the enemy who has done me so much wrong. Eomer shall come with me, and see that my aged feet do not falter."
"As you will," said Gandalf. "Aragorn shall come with me. Let the others await us at the foot of the stairs. They'll hear and see enough, if there's anything to hear or see."
"Nay," said Gimli, "Legolas and I wish for a closer view. We alone here represent our kindreds. We also will come behind."
"Come then," said Gandalf, and with that he climbed the steps, and Theoden went beside him. The riders of Rohan sat uneasily upon their horses, on either side of the stair, and looked up darkly at the great tower, fearing what might befall their lord. Merry and Pippin sat on the bottom step, feeling both unimportant and unsafe.
"Half a sticky mile from here to the gate," muttered Pippin. "I wish I could slip off back to the guard-room unnoticed. What did we come for? We're not wanted." Gandalf stood before the door of Orthonk and beat on it with his staff. It rang with a hollow sound.
"Saruman! Saruman!" he cried in a loud, commanding voice. "Saruman, come forth!"
For some time there was no answer. At last the window above the door was unbarred, but no figure could be seen at its dark opening.
"Who is it?" said a voice.
"What do you wish?"
Theoden started.
"I know that voice," he said, "and I curse the day when I first listened to it. Go and fetch Saruman. Since you've become his footman, Grima Wormtongue," said Gandalf, and don't waste our time."
The window closed. They waited. Suddenly another voice spoke, low and melodious, its very sound an enchantment. Those who listened unwarily to that voice could seldom report the words that they heard, and if they did, they wondered, for little power remained in them. Mostly they remembered only that it was a delight to hear the voice speaking. All that it said seemed wise and reasonable, and a desire awoke in them by swift agreement to seem wise themselves. When others spoke, they seemed harsh and uncouth by contrast, and if they gainsaid the voice, anger was kindled in the hearts of those under the spell. For some the spell lasted only while the voice spoke to them, and when it spoke to another they smiled, as men do who see through a juggler's trick while others gape at it. For many the sound of the voice alone was enough to hold them enthralled, but for those whom it conquered the spell endured when they were far away, and ever they heard that soft voice whispering and urging them. But none were unmoved. None rejected its pleas and its commands without an effort of mind and will, so long as its master had control of it.
"Well," it said now with gentle question, "why must you disturb my rest? Will you give me no peace at all by night or day?"
Its tone was that of a kindly heart aggrieved by injuries undeserved. They looked up, astonished, for they had heard no sound of his coming, and they saw a figure standing at the rail, looking down upon them, an old man, swathed in a great cloak, the colour of which was not easy to tell, for it changed if they moved their eyes, or if he stirred. His face was long, with a high forehead. He had deep, darkling eyes, hard to fathom, though the look that they now bore was grave and benevolent, and a little weary. His hair and beard were white, but strands of black still showed about his lips and ears.
"Like, and yet unlike," muttered Gimli.
"But come now," said the soft voice.
"Two at least of you I know by name. Gandalf I know too well to have much hope that he seeks help or counsel here. But you, Theoden, Lord of the Mark of Rohan, are declared by your noble devices, and still more by the fair countenance of the House of Eorl. A worthy son of Thengel the thrice-renowned, why have you not come before, and as a friend? Much have I desired to see you, mightiest king of western lands, and especially in these latter years, to save you from the unwise and evil counsels that beset you. Is it yet too late? Despite the injuries that have been done to me, in which the men of Rohan, alas, have had some part, still I would save you, and deliver you from the ruin that draws nigh inevitably if you ride upon this road which you've taken. Indeed, I alone can aid you now."
This ends Disc 7.